Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lin Yang.
The hit Transformer movies have robots that change from everyday items into robot warriors. But what if a robot could assemble itself?
And as soon as that brain is told to start running, it goes through the process of telling each circuit to turn on or off. And then once it knows that it's assembled, it tells the robot to walk forward.
You might never have heard of the Van Allen belt, but life on Earth would be very different without it.
We also have a lot of satellites that fly through that area, communication satellites, navigation satellites. And so we need to understand what it is that the effects are, because the effects can be quite dramatic.
How safe is the U.S. nuclear arsenal?
We'll meet a man devoted to saving some of the world's most endangered species.
Can cats be trained like dogs?
And there's a popular diner that offers locally grown, healthy alternatives to traditional fare.
That's all coming up on this Tuesday edition of Now. Lin, are you a fan of the Transformers movies?
I would say I like them. You're not a fan? I love Doctor Who more, but it's cool.
Doctor
it's cool
Who.
That cars can, move and assemble themselves into robots and fight each other.
Like Optimus Prime, you're not a big Optimus fan? Okay, well, he's a semi-truck anyway. You know, in those movies, common everyday vehicles like a truck or a car can change into heroic warriors.
But that's fantasy. What if robots can assemble themselves in real life?
VOA's Roseanne Skirbel introduces us to a Harvard scientist who is using principles of an ancient art to make modern robots.
In the microrobotics laboratory at Harvard, graduate student Sam Felton is building tiny robots from what appears to be flat sheets of paper. He spoke to VOA via Skype about his most recent project.
We started with a desire to make robots as quickly and cheaply as possible. And so we looked to origami in order to find ways to create very complex and functional machines. Mathematically, origami can create almost anything you'd want, but the trick is to actually get it to happen in real life with real materials.
To make it happen, Felton uses shape memory polymers, flat plastic sheets that change shape in response to heat.
Additionally, we combined it with other materials. We use paper as a substrate to give it an extra stiffness and to give it something to pull against.
Electronics embedded between the layers are programmed to kick the folding process into action, triggered by an onboard battery.
And we supply these with current, much like you'd supply a light bulb with current. And that heats up that local area to above 100 degrees Celsius. And so once it hits 100 degrees Celsius, the shape memory polymer shrinks, and that pulls on the paper, causing it to fold over.
The operation starts within 10 seconds.
And as soon as that brain is told to start running, it goes through the process of telling each circuit to turn on or off. And then once it knows that it's assembled, it tells the robot to walk forward.
The robot assembles itself in just 4 minutes.
What we showed here is that you could embed all these systems onto an autonomous robot and cause it to control its own folding. In previous examples, there was always an operator behind. As you said, someone had to flip the switch to supply the electricity. In this case, it's flipping its own switch.
Felton says researchers can quickly produce complex robots of different sizes and strong for their weight, and they can be shipped flat in large quantities.
I like to think about assembling in space. If you could send a ream of flat sheets up that then turn themselves into satellites, or even send that ream to another planet and have it turn itself into a new base.
Felton says such a machine has other potential applications, including delivery to confined spaces, like collapsed buildings for search and rescue missions. The work is described in the current issue of the journal Science. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
So this guy uses the principles of origami, which was invented in China, by the way.
Yay!
It's a Japanese word, but because the Chinese invented paper, they invented the folding thing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, if robots can assemble itself, then it saves labor, saves a lot of time.
Yeah.
My worry is, what if they go...
If they go rogue.
Crazy, yeah.
If they become Destructicons.
I know. And then they're going to kill the human species. Oh, my gosh.
You are now redundant.
but it's an excellent technology to have.
Yeah.
And you know, in fields of production or any kinds of production lines to have to use machines.
Let's just hope they don't have red glowing eyes.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, if you want to see video of these self-assembling robots, I promise they're not dangerous. You can log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts of them by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. Northern Lights.
Have you seen them?
Have I seen them?
Yeah.
No. I've only seen them. You know, it's funny because...
I heard they're beautiful.
They're beautiful, but the time you have to see them is like winter time, and you have to go somewhere like Iceland or Greenland or Norway.
Yeah.
It's cold up there. Yeah, no, but some of the radiation from the Aurora Borealis, you know, that's actually created by solar flares. Mm. When the sun shoots off one of these big flares, that radiation hits the Earth, and the Northern Lights, as they're called, they get kind of tossed out. Mm.
But apparently, some of that radiation could damage sensitive satellites or even electrical systems here on Earth.
That is, except for what's known as the Van Allen Belt. VOA's George Putich tells us about the belt and its vital function.
Space weather can be as unpredictable as the weather on Earth. Periodic eruptions on the sun's surface eject huge clouds of highly charged protons and electrons. Some of them reach the Earth and cause spectacular light displays like the Aurora Borealis or Northern Lights. When the clouds of charged particles are unusually strong, they can knock out power grids, disrupt communications, and even damage electronic equipment. But most of the time, they get trapped by the Earth's magnetic field in the so-called the Van Allen radiation belt. Nevertheless, they can still inflict damage, says NASA's program scientist Mona Kessel.
We also have a lot of satellites that fly through that area, communication satellites, navigation satellites. And so we need to understand what it is that the effects are, because the effects can be quite dramatic.
To learn more about space weather, NASA in 2012 launched a pair of satellites built by Applied Physics Laboratory. Called Van Allen probes, they were to explore the mysterious belt. At first, researchers expected only quantitative data, says project scientist Barry Mok.
I was skeptical we would find anything surprising. In fact, we found tremendous surprise. We found new structures that we never anticipated.
The Van Allen probes discovered that instead of two layers, the belt has an occasional third layer of charged particles and that they sometimes form zones called zebra stripes. The probes also found how the electric and magnetic fields additionally energize the particles. Mok says measurements gathered by the two probes will help scientists develop computer models for creating space weather forecasts.
If I see something at the sun, a flare or something, and I can measure the magnetic field on the sun, there are remote ways of doing that, I can now predict how will the radiation belts respond to that.
And that, he says, may lead to sending the astronauts to their vaults or powering down the communication and navigation satellites while this effect passes by.
And then we also just want to understand it because it's a very dynamic part of our whole space above the Earth, our electromagnetic space.
Scientists say better understanding of the Van Allen radiation belt will help us prepare for potential surprises from our own sun. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of the Van Allen belt in action, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And leave your questions or comments at our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And remember to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. The Cold War has been over for many years now, but the remnants of that conflict, including huge arsenals of nuclear weapons, remain.
In both the United States and Russia, hundreds of nuclear missiles remain ready to be launched within 10 minutes.
But VOA's Kane Faribault tells us that recent scandals involving those responsible for handling nuclear weapons in the U.S. military have renewed the debate about the risk and the need for such weapons.
Below the surface of the Oscar Zero launch facility outside Cooperstown, North Dakota. The fate of millions of people once hinged on a simple decision to turn a nuclear missile launch key. Once that key activated a nuclear-tipped Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM, there would have been no turning back and no limit to the death and destruction it would cause.
The people that had these jobs, these missileers, they took their jobs very seriously.
Gwen Hinman is the site supervisor at the Oscar Zero Complex, now a kind of Cold War museum. Decommissioned in 1998 in compliance with the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty 2, or START 2, Hinman says this facility gives visitors a unique look into the lives of those who served and continue to serve in some of the most isolated conditions.
This bank of machinery behind me is something that's still currently being used.
Used in an operational facility just a few hundred kilometers away, says Hinman. Lacks security in such facilities in other states, a cheating scandal among some serving as missileers, and an overall lack of mission focus since the end of the Cold War has drawn attention to an almost forgotten part of the U.S. military.
These are complex systems, and they're run by humans who make errors.
Kennett Benedict is the executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a publication established by those who created the first atomic bomb in the 1940s, as a way to warn the public about the consequences of using nuclear weapons. The bulletin also manages the Doomsday Clock, a graphic representation of how close the world is to a nuclear catastrophe. The closer the clock gets to midnight, the greater the danger. The clock currently stands at 5 minutes to midnight, not solely because of the danger of war, says Benedict, but by the danger posed by mishandling a nuclear weapon.
Over the course of these last 60, 70 years, at least in our arsenal, there have been more than 1,200 accidents.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Air Force removed 50 nuclear missiles from their silos, bringing the total number of launch-ready land-based ICBMs to about 400, the lowest level since the Cold War. Benedict says there should be a stand-down of all the missiles.
And the thing that we've been asking this president and many presidents to do is just take them off of a high launch readiness. There's no reason that these weapons need to be ready to be launched within 10 minutes of an order. Nobody does that except the United States and Russia.
The current agreement between the United States and Russia limits the number of deployed strategic nuclear missiles to 700 for each country. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Cooperstown, North Dakota.
So what do you think? Do these arsenals have to be on high alert?
Let us know your thoughts by logging onto our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Or you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Tomorrow way too far away, and we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now.
Hawaii is cleaning up from the after effects of a large storm that hit the islands in the past week.
Because of its isolation, Hawaii is home to an incredible bounty of plants.
It is also the home of many endangered species.
Heidi Chang introduces us to a man whose life work has been preserving some of the most endangered plants on Earth for four decades.
When botanist Steve Perlman takes you hiking on the island of Kauai, you can tell he's passionate about preserving Hawaii's rich natural heritage. The state has 1,200 native plant species. 90% of them are not found anywhere else in the world. But that natural heritage has been disappearing because of invasive plants and animals, habitat loss due to agriculture and development, and unpredictable natural events such as hurricanes and droughts.
Feral animals are here and destroying the regeneration, but weeds are really a huge threat here. So
Perlman has been trying to reverse that trend for more than 40 years. He's one of Hawaii's original rock star botanists, literally. In the 1970s, he pioneered rappelling down high cliffs to save the Brinkhamia insignis, a rare Hawaiian plant known as the alula.
A lot of the botanists in the old days, at least for the first couple hundred years working in Hawaii, would be able to hike the ridges and the valleys and find their species. But no one had ever really looked at the cliffs. And so once I learn how to rope onto the cliffs to get to the Brighamia and pollinate them and get the seed. Then I started using those same cliff climbing techniques to get to other plants.
Now in his 60s, Perlman is still rappelling off cliffs, working to save endangered plants that have managed to establish a foothold in places where ravenous goats and pigs can't reach them.
I would say that it's very dangerous, but the most dangerous part is really the falling rocks. And yes, you have to not be very afraid of heights because you're often 1,000 feet or even up to 2,000 feet above the ocean or above a cliff. And if you fall, yes, you would die.
Although his rough terrain work is dangerous, Perlman says it's worth it to see a species survive.
We know the Amazon is losing all these species and all, but Hawaii is losing species. There's an extinction crisis going on here, and we've already had over 100 species go extinct.
After a long career as a field botanist at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, Perlman is now the statewide specialist for Hawaii's Plant Extinction Prevention Program. The program focuses on protecting species with fewer than 50 plants remaining in the wild.
This Plant Extinction Prevention Program is putting thousands of native plants, critically endangered plants, back out into the areas on the islands where they grew, and we're seeing that success.
Through his work, Perlman also continues to discover new species, like the Hibiscadelphus trees that he and his colleagues found growing in a remote steep valley on the island of Maui. His explorations often take him to pristine places. He recalls an especially memorable expedition to the highest peak on the island of Molokai.
It's like being someone like a Charles Darwin who has just gotten to come to an island that no one's ever been to, and everything is interesting, the birds, the insects, the plants, and you're like the first person in this kind of place. So we may rediscover something old, or we may find something brand new. And so it's like the age of discovery is not really over.
Today, with more than half of Hawaii's native plants threatened with extinction, Steve Perlman's conservation work remains an inspiration for those who share his dream of making a difference. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Hawaii.
So what do you think? Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can also email us at voaasia@voanews.com.
And follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. Lynn, do you have a pet? You have a dog, cat, a bird, something like that?
I don't have anything for now, but growing up, we always have birds in our family.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of bird?
Just parrots.
Like a parrot, big parrot, or a parakeet, like a little blue
they're,
one?
They're cute small ones.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Because it's in China and we live in flats, like condos, so it's
it's
hard to raise big dogs.
Yeah,
cats maybe.
But when many people think of training pets, they probably don't think of cats. They do think of, like me, with a dog. But, you know, Shelley Schlender introduces us to a woman who not only trains domesticated cats, but she also gets them to perform in a stage show.
Grumpy Cat, Garfield, the Cat in the Hat. On YouTube and in cartoons, books, and movies, these famous cats all seem to have one thing in common. They're too clever by half, and they don't follow directions. And one other thing, they never, ever, ever do tricks.
If laying on your back and wanting a belly rub's a trick, I guess then they're really good at it.
I think dogs are easier to train, because cats sleep all day.
Enter the Acrocats. Samantha Martin leads these talented felines. She says the Acrocats started out as orphans, strays, or abandoned pets. She adopted them from animal shelters, then taught them a trick. Or two. Or three. Or four. In addition to training the Acrocats, Martin sometimes invites animal shelters to loan her hard-to-adopt kittens. Like these.
There were ones that were at the shelter that were a little bit bigger than some of the others. Everybody was going for the smaller ones. And, you know, the clock was ticking. And the longer they're in there, the harder it is for them to be adopted. So I said, well, I'll take these three, and I bet you I can find them a home within the month.
She says she trains them in just the same way she trains the Acrocats, using techniques that can work for anyone. When a cat does something perfectly, she immediately makes a clicking sound. Then she follows up with a tasty treat,
So we give them boiled chicken, salmon, and ahi tuna.
In just 1 week, Martin says these little lion kings have learned to stand on pedestals and soon will learn even more.
What owner's going to give up a cat that jumps through a hoop or high-fives them when they come home from work?
Martin encourages everyone to adopt a feline friend from their local animal shelter, saying every cat can be a star. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Boulder, Colorado.
If you want to see video of these trained cats in action, you can log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter. We're at Now VOA Show.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Diners are a uniquely American style of restaurant with a distinct look and a menu that can be found virtually everywhere across the U.S.
They specialize in so-called comfort food, simple, filling, and inexpensive.
But as VOA's Julie Tabo recently discovered, one innovative chef has taken the popular diner concept to a whole new level with surprising results.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Push that bag so.
The voice of legendary American rocker Bill Haley pours out of a jukebox at the packed Silver Diner in Waldorf, Maryland, as customers wait in line to be seated. A jukebox at every booth is just one of the many features the Silver Diner shares with the thousands of diners across America, along with the vinyl booths and an Art Deco theme characterized by neon signs, stainless steel, and large glass windows that cover the restaurant's exterior. What sets this diner apart from the others is the menu, which keeps customers like Ashley Holt and Sergeant First Class Norman Bailey coming back.
I like the food. It's fresh. It's good. I would come here more often, especially because it's a lot healthier.
Great atmosphere, quick service, and great food.
You want the waffle and eggs?
Yes, please.
Yes, ma'am.
That great food comes courtesy of executive chef Ipa von Hengst, who co-founded the first Silver Diner with his partner Bob Jaimo 25 years ago.
I also feel really that it's my moral obligation that I need to provide a better product for people. And when I did, surprisingly, and somehow not surprisingly, we noticed that, you know, the volume started coming back. And over the last 3 years, we have gone up by 30% in customer count, which is phenomenal.
On this warm, sunny day, Chef Ipa picked zucchini and yellow squash with Chris Parker, whose family farm has been supplying the restaurant with fresh produce for years. Ipa will incorporate the vegetables he helped pick into one of the many non-traditional dishes he will offer on this evening's menu, stir-fried pasta primavera.
This is not a fad. This is here to stay. People are going to want healthier food. They're going to want better food. If you don't jump on this, you're going to be out of business.
Today, the partners own 15 Silver Diners, almost all in the Washington, D.C. area, serving 10,000 customers a week with tasty, nutritious food and a generous dose of caring on the side.
This is my passion. If you don't have a passion for what you're doing, you really need to get out of it.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Waldorf, Maryland.
To see Chef Ipa von Hengst in action, visit our webpage. That's www.voanews.com.
And don't forget to leave us your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this Tuesday edition of Now.
If you want to see videos of the stories on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
That's also where you can download copies of our show, and we're on iTunes.
Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Now VOA Show.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until tomorrow, I'm Lin Yang.
And I'm David Byrd. Join us again Wednesday for another edition of Now.